What I want to do today is pick up from the fifth chapter, okay? Let's get started. We'll pick up. Okay, so last week we were discussing a little bit what we discussed the difference between the approach of the kingdom of Ahasuerus and the Jewish point, the idea of certainty versus uncertainty. I phrase it differently. You know, we do new things when we review, which is good. But we were discussing that in the in Ahasuerus' kingdom, it's yodei dat v'din. Everybody knows what to do, and it's a very fatalistic approach. Once something is done, it can never be undone. So when they send out the first letters to attack the Jews on the 13th of Adar, and then when they're going to send out a few months later the second letters that the Jews can defend themselves, they should have rescinded the first letters. But that's not what they do there, because fate, in a certain sense, can't be changed. Everything is sort of works by nature. Ahasuerus doesn't want to do it. He calls the cabinet, and it says, Yodei Daf Bedin. They know the pathways of the law and the, you know, dat is often in modern Hebrew translated as religion, but I think it really means these are the ways of the world. It cannot be changed. And of course, Mordechai says to Esther, "Umi odeya im ka'et kazot hikath l'machud." And who knows if this is the reason you became the queen? In other words, when he's trying to convince her to go to Ahasuerus to say on behalf of the Jewish people, we don't know. And that's, of course, we said the first class that the basic theme of the Megillah is how to live a life as a Jew in the exile without God. That's us for the last 2,500 years. In other words, God doesn't speak to us. Many people don't believe in God. We don't see any evidence of God. So, in other words, God is hidden. Hester Panim, God is hidden. And how do we live? There are no prophets. We don't know what to do. And that's the story of the Megillah. And that's why there's no context, because it's a constant story. So where it's a life of uncertainty. And that's one of the messages of the Megillah. And we discussed this also, why, therefore, there's no Hallel. And we don't say songs of praise. We say on all the other holidays. The Megillah ends with the Jews paying, you know, taxes. Nothing really happens at the end of the story. So it's got this, on the one hand, it's like the happiest day and the most like joyous day. On the other hand, it's not so great. I guess we enjoy it while we can, but we always have to know that there's a new Haman on the horizon. But we can be, on the other hand, we win. We're in a sense, and we are still here. But that was one of the ideas, the difference between sort of the Persian approach and the Jewish approach. I mean, it's because Haman's appeal, you know, why he wants to kill all the Jews. What does Ahasuerus know, which we'll come to a little bit today. And I think we discussed Adar, right? Why the difference, when we talk about Purim, is the time where God is hidden. So Pesach is the time where man is hidden, where God is manifest. And at the Pesach Seder, Moshe's name doesn't appear. That's ridiculous. That's like atzuf for misrepresentation. To tell the story of the Exodus, you don't mention Moshe's name. How can you dare do that? But that's exactly the point. How can you tell the story of Esther without God's name? But that's the point. At the beginning of the year, the beginning of Jewish history, we want to bang on the Jewish people. Everything comes from God, so we ignore the role of man. And on Purim, we ignore the role of God. And of course, they go together. But in other words, it's really, neither are exactly accurate like that. It's a partnership. And that's why Purim has to be in the second Adar, because we want Purim next to Pesach. We don't, because really Purim should be in the first Adar, when we do it the first thing. So that's the idea that Purim and Pesach are really polar opposites, but they just reflect the same thing in two different ways. Pesach, you know, it really, and of course, Pesach HaKol Mesudar. It's a Seder. Everything is order. Purim is the most unordered Hefkeris. You know what Hefker is, right? You know what Hefker is?
No.
What's Hefker? I mean, I know what it is.
Chaos.
Chaos. Hefker is ownerless. You do whatever you want. Like, it's the total opposite. But again, it's the flip side of the same coin, the Seder. But in a certain sense, when God is running things, there's a Seder. But when man runs things, and from our perspective, there's basically it's chaos. But Purim and Pesach go together. So as we go from one to the other, and also, you know, as we get older, in a sense, Purim is the last of the holidays. Hanukkah doesn't even make it. Hanukkah is not in the Bible. It's Hanukkah, in that sense, really is a lower status holiday. The obligation to hear the Megillah is a higher level obligation. Hanukkah is a rabbinic mitzvah. Purim is sort of Medivrei Kabbalah, we call it. Sort of a, it's in the Bible. It's not in the five books of the Torah, but it's in the Bible. Anyways, that's for another discussion. But Purim marks the end of the biblical period. Okay. I think what we ended off with, I think, last class, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, and if not, you won't. Okay, so I'll be wrong anyway. So, okay, so that we have the Parsha breaks. How the first way you're supposed to understand the Chumash, I don't know why nobody does this, is you open up the Chumash here. So let's see. Let's go to the beginning. So here, at the end of each day of creation, there's a little space in the Chumash. This space appears in the Sefer Torah. If a sofer writes a Sefer Torah and he doesn't leave these empty spaces, the Sefer Torah is invalid. It's supposed to, here it's a long space. So I know this is what we call, it goes all the way to the end of the line. And sometimes when you have a long story, like here, space there. You go to Parshat Vayetze. Parshat Vayetze, I just happen to remember that. Parshat Vayetze, which is, what's the main story in Vayetze? Yaakov runs away from Esav. Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva. He goes to Haran, he's running away. And he meets, he eventually makes his way he meets like Rachel at the well, and then he goes to Laban's house, and then he has 11 children. All kind, it's a huge thing. And Leah and Rachel, and he gets tricked who to marry. Guess what? Look here. Look at the pages. No break. In other words, the birth of the children is bang, 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 bang. In other words, that's what the Torah is saying to us. And that's how it reads when you read it. Obviously, it took time, but that's not how it read. There are no Parsha breaks. In words, it's one story. Yaakov going to Laban, running away from Esav. It's all one story. That's the first way we should read the Chumash. It has nothing to do with how long it is. Sometimes it's every two verses. It has to do with a thematic idea. Every time a theme ends, the Torah puts a Parsha break, and then we have to, we're supposed to pause, that's what Rashi is, and review what did we learn before we move on. And realize there's a break in the story, and now we're going to continue. So why am I telling you all this? It's good to know. But if you look, I hope it's good to know. So we'll get to it in chapter 6 when the king can't sleep. But let's start in chapter 5. You'll see it in the Megillah. It should be, I hope it's printed in your Megillah where it's empty, where it's not. If I go here, the art scroll doesn't. I don't know that every Chumash that they print does it, but art scroll is very into this kind of stuff. By the way, that there is here. Where's Esther? I'm just trying to the Chumash Megillot. Esther, Balayla Hahu. No, see, chapter 5. In other words. Chapter 4 ends that Esther agrees to go to Ahasuerus. They have this back and forth. Mordechai is out by the king's palace. He's ripping his clothes, wearing sackcloth. And they're saying, you can't do this. You can't come to Parliament Hill wearing, sackcloth. You're going to make, or the White House, or the king of Saudi Arabia. That's probably more like it. Okay, you get shot if you dress like that here. So back and forth, and Mordechai convinced Esther to go, and then Esther says, fine, go fast for 3 days, and these are, of course, the 3 days of Pesach, the first, the first 3 days of Pesach, the Jewish people are fast, maybe Erev Pesach, maybe the 14th, 15th, and 16th, because it decrees on the 13th of Nisan, so the Jewish people are fasting, and then on the third day, Vayhi Bayom HaShlishi, this beginning of chapter 5, page 16 in these little books that we have. So we mentioned in our first class, I think the first thing we mentioned, is Megillat Esther, being the last book pretty much of Tanakh, is a commentary on many other books. The same way the breaks tell us how to read without commentary. In other words, just read it and figure out where to stop and pause. So the books of Tanakh comment on one another. That's the book of Bereishit can't comment on very much because there's nothing to comment on. But by the time you get to the book of Esther, there's a lot to comment on. So we spent half a class discussing how the story of Yosef, the story of Megillah is really the story of Yosef, just told over. Good looks and a Jew in a foreign power, and the king can't sleep, and the plots and everything, and the butler and the baker, and Bigdan and Teresh, and everything is the same, and the word is the same. We didn't go through that carefully, but there are 50 versions where the words of Megillat Esther are just like pulled from the text of Yosef. We mentioned 127 kings. So that's the idea of Sarah, and Sarah being taken by the king of Egypt against her will. 127 is not, these numbers aren't real numbers there. I mean, they may be, but I don't care if they are or they aren't. They probably aren't. So these numbers are similar. Or Mordechai cried a deep and bitter cry. That's the exact same language by Esav. So, and the rabbis say, when Yaakov stole the blessing. We paid for it 1,000 years later in Shushan, or 1,500 years later. The rabbis see all these parallels between Esther and earlier books. So, Vayhi Vayom HaShlishi. So, on the third day, you don't know anything except you know the Chumash very well. Let's say you're you're living in the early biblical period. You never heard of the Gemara, you never heard of anything, but you know the Chumash off by heart. So, what is Vayhi Vayom HaShlishi? What two, I think, maybe there are more, but I can think of two places in the Chumash where we have on the third day something happened.
Bereshit.
What do you mean Bereshit? You mean the third day creation of vegetation? That's not what I meant, but okay. It doesn't say Vayhi Vayom HaShlishi there, by the way. It says Vayhi Erev, Vayhi Boker, Yom Shlishi. In other words, God is creating in 6 days. It doesn't say on the third day. It says, I don't think it says on third day. It says at the end, Vayomer Elohim Yikavu Hamayim, or that's on the second day. Kachei Haaretz Desha Esav Mezriya Zera, if I remember it by heart. I don't know if I do, but whatever, right? Yikavu Hamayim Mitachar Shemayim Mamakom Achad. Vayihichem. And then only at the end, Vayalim Pitov, Vayihi Berbuk Yom Shlishi. It doesn't say Vayihi Bayom HaShlishi. That was the third day. It wasn't after 3 days. Where do we have Vayihi Bayom HaShlishi? There is one in Bereshit. Think of moments. Obviously, there's going to be a link between this and these other moments in Jewish history.
They went into the desert the third day when they camped.
Go on.
What? And they camped because they wanted to show the Egyptians or something that they'd gone
far. So Moshe says we're going to go to the desert for 3 days. I wasn't thinking of that one either, but good. That could fit. No.
Abraham's circumcision.
Uh-huh. Abraham's circumcision. We're going to get there, right. But let's one at a time. So you see already 3 days is sort of like a period of time of reflection. That's 3 days gives you enough time to reflect on something. But let's start. The first 3 days, how should we start? Okay, we'll start in order of the Chumash. I'll read it to you, I think. And then you'll tell me where it is.
Akedat
Yitzchak. You told me before I read it. Very good. Vayi, excellent. Vayom Hashlishi. Vayisa Avram et Einav Bayar et Hamakom Erchok. On the third day, Avram looks and he sees the mountain from afar. Akedat Yitzchak. We'll come back. What's the second one? So it is. There is with Egypt. That's also true. Running away from Egypt. That I didn't really think of that. It doesn't mean to say it was on the third day. He just said he'll go away for 3 days. But let's go chapter. I think it's here. It's Vayihi Bayom HaShlishi by Mamad Har Sinai.
Right.
The Jewish people prepare for 3 days. The Shloshet Yemei Hagbalah that we call it before we get the Torah on Shavuot. So what's the connection? In other words, what's the 3 days? So the rabbis say in the merit of the Brit Milah, and the merit of accepting the Torah, this is what saved the Jewish people. It's this whole idea that Jewish history is linked. This notion, it's hard for us to fully understand that what A does 1,000 years ago affects what we do nowadays. It's hard for us to know that, to accept it, but it's probably true in medicine, how our genetic makeup is. It's true. So what Yaakov did to Esav affects us. And the mayor, we spoke last week how Avraham Avinu saddling his donkey before Bilam did. It was the Haman said the machatzit hashekel, right? He's going to take the shkalim to wipe out the Jewish people. So the rabbis say, oh, you're shkalim. What are you talking about? We give half a shekel already, earlier. What does that mean? It means the Jewish people's action of giving half a shekel can defeat Haman's giving a shekel to Ahasuerus. So that's the way the rabbis read these stories. It's a little bit hard to prove this in a lab, but that what we do, A, affects what happens, B. Rabbis and I'm not making historical comments, but that's how they see the writing of the book. So the fact that the Jewish people accept the Torah, the fact that Avraham Avinu was willing to sacrifice Yitzchak is what gave the merit, gives the Jewish people the strength facing our adversaries. But I think it means a lot more than that. And that's the idea of Jewish history hanging in the balance. In other words, the problem with the Akedah is a whole separate, really big issue. But what's Avram's problem with the Akedah besides like figuring out if he's going to listen, right? What's Avram? The Akedah is an inherent contradiction because God told him the Jewish people are going to go through Yitzchak, and then God tells him to kill Yitzchak. Well, what does that mean? That's the end of Jewish history. In other words, that's it. If Yitzchak is the future, Yitzchak is your home, and then you say, okay, no, sorry, I changed my mind. You don't need Yitzchak, and that's it. So that's the end of Jewish history. At Har Sinai, what does the rabbi say? Okay, what did we say? And everybody knows this is a trick question, but that's okay. We'll see who we untrick. What did the Jewish people say at Mount Sinai?
Nasa
v'nishma. Everybody knows that, right? It's right or wrong. When did they say Nasa v'nishma?
The second time.
They said it later.
They said it later. Oh. I don't know when they said it. Maybe he's right.
They said Nasa.
We were all taught this. So, and it's, that's from, you learn Midrash and Muffin, you learn things as little kids, and then we don't come back and right. examine it later. We were all taught in kindergarten, in grade 1, and grade 2, 3, 4, in every garden, and every rabbi in Shavuos, the Jewish people said Nasa v'nishma. And there is a Midrash like that. That's not made up. And the words Nasa v'nishma do appear in the Torah, but they appear in the Torah in Mishpatim, like after they got the Torah. Now, we always thought Nasa v'nishma means before they got the Torah. In the Chumash, it appears later. Okay, whatever. On the same page in the Talmud that says, we said Nasa v'nishma, literally six lines apart, the Talmud says that when we came to Mount Sinai, God held up a mountain, and he said, either you accept the Torah, or Kafalem harkikigit, and he said, if not, I think I mentioned this. This is going to be your burial place. And what's fascinating is the Talmud, which is so attuned to questioning and little nuance of differences, but that's only in legal discussions. Whenever there's a legal discussion, the Talmud is concerned about every little viewpoint. What we heard on Shabbos a little bit. But when it comes to Agadah, when it comes to the non-legal portions, the rabbis are led all kinds of contradictory views. They have no interest in reconciling views. So these two views appear in the Talmud. On the surface, it's a total contradiction. Did we accept the Torah willingly or not? The rabbis understood that we did not accept the Torah willingly. It was only on Purim we accepted the Torah willingly. Vayhi bayom ha-shlishi is coming back to the day of Har Sinai. And eventually, the Jewish people are going to have a re-acceptance of Torah. We meant Yom Kippurim. Of Purim, but the rabbis also say something half. They accepted part of the Torah willingly and part of the Torah not willingly. Which part of the Torah did they accept willingly? I do this sometimes in school. I think it's a great exercise. We should do it. Adults are maybe too afraid to do it. But if you could change like 10 laws in the Torah, what would they be? Like, well, you know, if it was up to you. Like, the kids sometimes ask me things, you know. So I say, listen, as an observant Jew, a religious Jew who believe God gave us the Torah, I accept everything in the Torah. It doesn't mean I like everything in the Torah. There may be certain laws I would prefer weren't in the Torah, but just like in any society. It doesn't mean I deny its authority. I realize I'm an idiot, I don't understand anything, whatever, or whatever. God had a different view than I have. Okay, what can I do? I have to accept it. You don't have to like everything you do. But so the rabbis say the Jewish people accepted part of the Torah, but not the other part of the Torah. What part of the Torah did they accept?
Shabbos.
So, okay, there is one that they accept that they got earlier. But no, the rabbis divide between the oral law and the written law. The Torah Shebichtav and Torah Shebal Peh. The written law they accepted, the oral law they refused to accept. The oral law is Purim. The written law is Yom Kippur. The oral law is Purim. What does that mean? Why would they accept the written law, not the oral law? They can say it's harder. How do you keep Shabbos according to the written law? If you only had the Torah, how would you keep Shabbos? I mean, we wouldn't know what to do with anything because the Torah is unclear, but a little bit we would know.
There'd only be three things you can't do, or two things you can't do.
I would argue one thing you can't do. One thing you can't do on Shabbat.
You can't carry, you can't go.
You can't light a fire. Lo tovar reish b'chol moshvatechem. Maybe you can't plow and
b'chashir b'chashir. Put your oxen together.
Well, you'd say, yeah, okay, I'm sorry.
Your animals, you can't.
Yeah, in other words, everything we do, all the laws that we do are, you know, how many times would you have to pray a day according to the Torah?
Once.
Maximum.
No,
and the Torah itself,
it's
unclear if you ever have to pray.
It's
that's the Ramban interpreting the Torah. Fine. So once in a blue moon. So you could say the oral Torah just add layers and layers of complexity and difficulty. But I don't think that's what the rabbis mean. When the rabbis say we accept the or who from the perspective of the rabbis, the worldview of the rabbis. So what's the written Torah? That's the word of God. What's the oral Torah?
Man's
the interpretation of man. So you tell somebody, you know, who is this rabbi to tell me what to do? If God tells me what to do, that's one thing. But the rabbi, why should I accept the authority of the rabbis? And again, it's the whole idea, God is hidden. In the oral law, God is hidden. It's all man revealing what we think. And you know what? That's the famous, everybody, did I tell the story yet? The trees going backwards, the oven, the tanur shalachnai, who knows that story? David, are you the only one? There's the famous story in the Talmud where they had a ridiculous fight over total irrelevancy. That's usually how most fights are. Why do I say it was relevant at one point in Jewish history? It was arcane but it was relevant when there was a temple about the laws of purity and impurity about an oven. But the people arguing this argument are living 100 years after the temple was destroyed, or 50 years after the temple is destroyed, and they're having an argument. And the argument got so fierce that Rav Elazar, that's the famous Rav Elazar says, if I'm right, you see that tree over there, I'm going to snap my fingers, it's going to move 100 feet. And he snapped his fingers and guess what?
The tree didn't move.
It moved 100 feet. And what did the rabbis say? We're not impressed. And he said, if I'm right, let the river flow backwards. And he snapped his finger. I don't know if he snapped his fingers. That's my addition. But whenever he snapped his finger, the rivers flew backwards. And the rabbis were not impressed. And he said, if I'm right, you see the walls in the Beit Midrash? We're sitting in the study hall. They're going to come and tumble in. And they started to tumble in. And the rabbis, then they got a little bit nervous. They thought the building's going to collapse. So they asked off. So the Talmud says it stopped, but it didn't go back. Out of respect for Rabbi Lesser, it didn't stay. The rabbi said, we're not impressed. And then he pulled out his wild card, his whatever. He said, okay, if I'm right, let God himself come. And the Talmud says, you don't have to take these stories, literally, but they're beautiful, powerful stories. If I'm right, let a voice from heaven came. And guess what? A butt call. A heavenly voice came and said Rabbi Lesser was right. And Rabbi Yoshua... So these are the same, like at the Haggadah, Rav Elazar, Rav Yeshua, Rav Tarpon, we're sitting in Bnei Brak, it's the same people. This is the generation after the temple, really, maybe two generations after destruction of the temple. They're in Yavne, Rabban Gamliel is their leader, and Rav Yeshua stands up and he quotes a verse in the Torah. It's a verse in Torah, but it's out of context. He takes the quotes in the verse and he says, Torah lo b'shamayim hi, the Torah is not in heaven. That verse at the end of the Torah in Hazinu or Vayelech, I think, is Moshe Rabbeinu was telling the Jewish people, the mitzvah I'm giving Torah, it's not so hard, I'm going to die. It's not so hard, you can do it. It's not in the heavens, it's not across the sea, and it's not too hard. He took that expression, Loba Shemayim, and said, Torah is not in heaven. And that means when God gave the Torah, he gave it to man. The Torah is meant for man. Once God gave the Torah, God has no say in the interpretation of Torah. And that's what Jewish law says. Hmm. So if you have an argument between God and the rabbis win. Isn't that amazing? The rabbis can overrule God. Because once the Torah is meant to be gray, and that's why Beit Shammai and Beit Hillel are always arguing. There's so many arguments. The Torah can be interpreted in many ways on purpose. We discussed that a little bit. We discussed that on the Chamaliva, which when I spoke about ago. The Torah can purposely be interpreted. And what God's opinion is doesn't matter. We want to figure out, but if we use the tools that we believe are given at Sinai, that's how we apply the Torah in real life. So that's, now, you got to be a real believer to believe that stuff. I mean, I'll take that God stuff, but like the rabbi arguing on God, we live in a different era, but if you think about throughout history, when religion is sort of the key to life, who is the religion? Some rabbi going to go against what it says? We have a sign from heaven. We don't listen to signs from heaven. We listen to the scholars. They write a paper and rabbis critique it and see who's right and people accept it. And that's how Jewish law works. So that's Esther. That's Purim. Purim is all about revealing the hidden Torah. It's all about man's role. And that's Vayehi Vayom HaShlishi. There's the Vayehi Vayom HaShlishi at Sinai, that's the oral law that we accepted. But we weren't willing to accept the written law. We weren't willing to accept the oral law until 1,500 years later at Purim time. Yes?
I have a question. Maybe it's my ignorance, but when Moshe Rabbeinu was starting to teach the people what he had learned on Har Sinai, and his father-in-law intervenes and says, you're on your way to a nervous breakdown unless you get some help, My understanding is that he was teaching the oral law that he had interpreted, and the, and was communicating that to the people, and the written version.
So let's do the other famous story about that. Very good. First, Yitro actually taught. There's a debate. We know the Torah is not necessarily in chronological order, but the story of Yitro telling Moshe you'll have a nervous breakdown if you don't get help is actually written before the Torah is given. It's the introduction to the Ten Commandments, which is a beautiful thing. The rabbis say there's wisdom in nation. Here you have a non-Jew, a pagan priest. The rabbis assumed he worshipped idols. He was an idolater. And yet the Torah puts the Ten Commandments in his parsha because he gave, brilliant advice. They had a close relationship, father-in-law and son-in-law. And he gave Moshe the advice, and that's the prelude to accepting the Torah. But to answer your question, was Moshe teaching the oral law? The answer is yes and no. How many weeks are we allowed to go on in this class, or how many hours do you have here tonight? We can go late, but there are different levels of oral law. But the simple answer is no. Is yes, God told Moshe that priates hadar means an etrog, let's say, for example, or he says that putting a sign on your arms means tefillin, and he described a little bit tefillin. Or putting a sign, writing on your doorpost is a mezuzah. I don't know what that means, right on my doorpost. So what does that mean? So that means a mezuzah, right? And the two parshiyot of the Shema. So yes, we do believe God gave Moshe a lot of things. We also, we have a term for that, like, it's not exactly what I was explaining now, but another concept, halacha l'moshe mi-Sinai, a law given by God at Mount Sinai. But the development of Torah, electricity on Shabbat, can you use it or not? You know, artificial insemination, is allowed in Jewish law? I mean, I think I'm a million questions you can ask. What do you do on the fly if you're in the North Pole? When do you keep Shabbos in the North Pole? So none of these questions are in the Torah. None of these questions were given to Moshe. The idea is that's developed. New things come. The entire Talmud, you know, you have a question. Is quinoa kosher for Pesach or not? I don't know that people get excited about that. Absolutely. Okay. Is it kidney yod or not? Who heard of kidney yod in the Torah? You know, but whatever. So much of the, yes, parts of the explanation to make the Torah intelligible to the people was given by Moshe. But the development of Torah in every generation and new things, did they know? That's a debate. How much did they know? How much was developed? But it appears, if you look at Tanakh, they didn't have so much. Even the laws of Shabbat were not developed. Even the whole notion of 39 melachot, you don't see that. I'm not saying it was, you know, it's developed till later on, and how do we derive things? So much of the laws developed. The famous, the other famous story that I like, two of my favorite stories, when Moshe and Rabbi Akiva meet at Mount Sinai. You know that story? Or I should go into that story too. I'll probably tell that story too. Okay, so the rabbis say, the rabbis were so beautifully creative, their imagery. So the rabbis say, when Moshe went to get the Torah, so he comes up to Mount Sinai, and God is like everybody, you know, he was procrastinating, you know, he was the night before, God had to get it all in, so to speak. You know, he's studying for the last night. So God was finishing writing the Torah. And you know, if you look in the Torah, on the letter Shatnes, I think, those letters have little crowns on them. If you open up a Torah, the Sheen has like three little crowns, the Tagim on the Sefer Torah. So God's filling up these things. And Moshe says to God, what are you doing here? What are these things? So Moshe, God says, yeah, it's not for you. It's not for you. But in 1,000 years... there's going to be this rabbi, Rabbi Akiva, and he's going to be Doresh. He's going to expound Tilei Tilim, like Tel Aviv, Tilei Tilim, mountains of Jewish law based on where these crowns are put. Now, interesting, we have no record of any of these laws that Rabbi Akiva expounded. Like, we don't know any law that's derived from a crown, but that's what the story says. So Moshe is blown away. So Moshe says, I want to meet this guy. Wow. So can I meet him? So God puts him in a time tunnel. And he transports him to the Beit Midrash of Rabbi Akiva. These stories, you just have to change the language. These stories are true. You know, people go, Einstein, you think Einstein and Descartes, and they meet, you know, what happened. You know, what? So Rabbi Akiva, Moshe Rabbeinu comes to Rabbi Akiva, and like anybody, he's a little, he doesn't know too many people, so he sits in the back. He sits in 8 rows back. There's probably a symbolism to why the number 8, I don't know. Anyway, sits 8 rows back, and he's listening. Rabbi Akiva's giving a class, and guess what? He doesn't understand one word. Doesn't understand what's going on. Giving a whole class for Rabbi Kiva. You know, it says in the Chumash this, and we say this, and we should. And Rabbi Kiva and Rabbi Shmuel are arguing with each other. Et Hashem al kachatiro. What does the word et mean? Kavei et. That's Rabbi Kiva's, you know, famous thing. The word et, he always said. So kavei et abicha, also your older brother. Moshe doesn't understand anything. So he's getting all nervous. This is terrible. I told the Jewish people, I'm going to die. I want you to keep Torah. Obviously, they're not keeping the Torah. They have this new religion. So he's all depressed. And finally, somebody asked a question, and Rabbi Kiva gives answers. So he says, where do you know that from? So Rabbi Kiva says, ah, halacha l'Moshe Mishinai. That was taught to Moshe at Mount Sinai. Ah, so Moshe was very happy. That's the end of the story. Did he understand one word? No, he didn't understand one word. What does that mean? The Torah develops in every generation. If to use our example, if Galileo were to come back and he would see an airplane, would he know what's going on? Would he know what's, you know, flying? You know, pardon the pun. Would he, you know? So he wouldn't know what's going on, but it's based on Galileo that we can build an airplane, right? It's built on Newton, that the laws of physics. He doesn't know how the laws of physics were developed, but without Newton, so the physicists of today say, Newton, this is all Newton. Newton said, what are you guys talking about? I never heard any of this. But Moshe Rabbeinu understood. So the Torah develops in every generation, and we don't understand it. I mean, you want to give it a very modern, practical application. It means the Torah in Europe and the Torah in America are different. And that was a huge mistake. I believe it's a whole other discussion. I believe hundreds of thousands of Jews are not observant because I don't blame them necessarily, and the Holocaust had a lot to do with it, and that's a whole different thing. But the rabbinic leaders were unable to transfer the Torah of Europe to America. They were unable to speak to modern Jews. Modernity killed Judaism. I mean that's why Orthodoxy developed, to say modernity is terrible, because they were seeing, you know, everybody left. I mean, the greatest rabbinic families, their kids were not really left, were, you know, a treif on Yom Kippur. I mean, you know, it was like people were becoming in droves non-religious.
That happened before North America.
Yeah, yes, yes. So I want to correct it more. It's modernity. The rabbis didn't know how to deal with modernity. It also happened in North America, but I agree. But everybody knows they threw... No, but it also happened on the boat. It's filling off the boat, you know.
Moses Mendelssohn's grandson, Felix Mendelssohn, was a goy. You know.
Yes, I know. So that's the whole dilemma. And I don't want to go there exactly. That's way off topic.
Was the goy. He acted like a goy.
No, but part of it is... We didn't know how to translate the term. The greatness of somebody like Rabbi Soloveitchik, who was the first person in my mind. Rabbi Soloveitchik was brilliant in so many things. When you learn Talmud, it's all very nice. But the greatest contribution of Rabbi Soloveitchik in my mind is that he taught that you could be a seriously observant Jew and a full-fledged American or Canadian at the same time. That was a tremendous insight. Nobody believed that. He came to North America in 1931. He arrived in Boston. Until that point, you had to choose. Either you're going to be a religious Jew, I'm going to be backwards. Nobody wanted that, so everybody left religion. Most people left religion. Go to any of your, you know, aunts and families. If you had a family of five kids and two were religious, that was, wow, that's an amazing family. Two out of five remain religious, or one out of four. It's not bad. One out of four is okay. You know, I mean, you had five out of five remain religious. That was unheard of. So, because it took a long time, because it was a whole different life. So, I use that as its own thing, but you have to know how to speak the language of Moshe Rabbeinu in Rabbi Akiva's, you know, generation. What worked for Rabbi Akiva doesn't work for Moshe. I mean, I made it into sort of a sociological thing, but that wasn't it. Okay. Anyways, back here. So the oral law develops. I thought I was going to do a lot more. They're all from three words in the Megillah.
We got four stories.
How many years is going to take us to get through the Megillah? I skip most.
It's always next year.
I skip. Vatilbash Esther HaMachut. Okay. So Esther is standing. Okay. Esther is standing, right? Nochach Beit HaMelech VaMelech Yoshev. What does Esther do? Why doesn't Esther approach the king? She's nervous.
Yeah.
We know she's very nervous. Kings might kill her. That's what she warned. Now, by the way, I meant to point this out last week. Go back to chapter 2 when Esther is appointed or enters the beauty contest. So chapter 2, I mentioned to look at Parsha Breaks, but I also mentioned the Tamei HaMikra Mapa, that's also Vayimain, right? With the Shalshelet. We discussed the four Shalshelet. That's the hesitation. So when Esther comes to the king, if anybody knows how to read the Megillah, we can do it. And you can tell me it's pretty obvious what it is, I think. So it's page 8, verse 15. Towards the about three quarters of the way down the page, Ubahagiyat Orester Vatavichayil Dod Mordechai. Right. So what's going on there? What's the verse saying? Asher Lakach Lo Lavat Lavo Elamelach Lo Bichadavar Ubahagiyat Orester Vatavichayil. You hear the hesitation, right? This is. And it was Esther's turn to come to the queen, the king. It's munach, right? It's like, and the word munach means like to put down, like to not to go anywhere. Lahaniach, right? Munach, four munachs. Esther doesn't want to go to the beauty contest. But eventually she has no choice. So it's just, there's this notion of hesitation. So here you are, it's the Esther just is standing there and doesn't know what's going to be. And what happens? Achashverosh sees her, and he likes her. He likes how she looks. That's all Achashverosh cares about. I mean, Megillah's making fun. The way they treat women is, you know, it's all about looks, and that's what he does. Vayihi k'rod ha-melech et Esther ha-malkah, when he saw her, nasach ein beinav. She found, you know, beauty in his eyes. So he gives her the scepter, and she touches the scepter, right? And then he says, Esther, what do you want? Okay, so now let's discuss a little like strategy instead of working. So what does Esther say? If you're Esther, what are you going to say? Mordechai's convinced you, you're the queen. Maybe this is why you became the queen, to save the Jewish people. Now's your opportunity. The Jewish people have fasted for 3 days now, right? This is the third day of the fast. Presumably, it's the third day of the fast itself. They're still fasting. And then Esther is going in. So what should she say? If you're Esther, what do you say? What do you say?
This Haman guy's no good.
This Haman guy's no good. Yeah, so why doesn't she say that?
She's got to lead up to it. She yeah. Just say it.
Yeah, why? No, so that we'll get there. Right now it appears, no, Haman's not there because he'll get killed. No one goes to the king unless they're called, right? No one, and there's no, it does not appear anybody's there. It appears they're alone.
She wants the king to start to suspect.
Okay, yeah, so you're already a step ahead. Haman's his most trusted advisor. Mordechai saved his life, and yet he appointed Haman. We discussed that last week, yet he appoints Haman to be his, whatever you call him, PM, I don't know, whatever job he had, right? That's where, you know, Mordechai saves life and immediately appoints Haman. Haman's his most trusted advisor. Mordechai, Esther goes around and says, this Haman's no good. Well,
who's going to believe?
His word against her word, right? Okay. So what does he say? He says, whatever you want, Esther, I'll give you half the kingdom. That's also a beautiful, the rabbi's comment. Mabak ad chatzi hamalkut. I'll give you up to half the kingdom. What does that mean?
So
is that a nice thing or a not nice thing to say? I'll give you up to half the kingdom. Whatever you want, up to half the kingdom.
Could be next to nothing.
Could be nothing, right. So the rabbis, it's not, the rabbis say it means not Jerusalem. Because the rabbis understood the Megillah as taking place between the destruction of the first temple and the building of the second temple. The party, the Kelim, that Achashverosh took were the vessels of the temple. And the Jews are sinning by partying where the temple vessels are, and the Jews should have gone back to the land of Israel, and they didn't go back. And these are sort of the assimilated Jews, and they're having a good time in Persia, right? So that's what's going on here in terms of, you know, on the Jewish people. So I won't let you build Jerusalem. In other words, you can have everything, but not the temple. Don't think of building the temple. That's what the rabbis, but that's not what it says in the pasuk. So what does it probably mean? It's like by Vashti. What happens at the party? Everybody can do whatever they want, except when the king asks you to do something, right? Ashtiakadat eino neis, lasot tirtzon ish for ish. The Gemara says you do whatever anybody wants. And then it says, Achashverosh calls Vashti, so she doesn't want to win it. Do whatever you want. Well, you can't do whatever you want. So Achazimach, Esther, I'll give you everything you want unless it's something I don't want to give you. That's what it appears to be saying. Achazimach. Anyways, just to point that out. So she said, let's go to, I want to make a party. I want to make a party. And who's going to come to the party? You and Haman. You and Haman are going to the party. Does the king like that idea?
Sure.
Why not? The king loves parties. He's making parties every other day. There are 10 parties in Megillah. So that's the it's a very, you know, he goes, and then comes to party two. Party two, what does Esther say? I'm sorry. It comes to party one. They come to the party. And then Machashir says, okay, what do you want? So what does Esther say? I want you to come to another party. Now that's already strange. What's she planning to do here? So you could say she's nervous. She's just nervous. She, you know, you have like, you want to go and you just can't bring yourself to do it. And you don't do it. You know, you ever had that? You know, you want to do something, you're going to do something, and you turn away at the last minute. I can't go through with this. So are you nuts? I'm the queen of the most powerful country in the world. I'm going to risk my queen for something like, I mean, we know how religious Esther is. We know how Jewish she is. What does she care? You know, what does she need this for? Maybe. I don't know. Or not. So she says, come tomorrow to a thing. And then what does Haman think? This is, of course, the irony, the beauty of the Megillah. In verse 9, Vayetze Haman vayamahu sameach v'tov lev. Haman leaves off, he's happy and a great heart. It's so sad. Ukeron Haman at Mordechai b'shar hamelech, lo kam v'lo zamen. And when he saw Mordechai in the king's gate, and Mordechai didn't move when he saw him. Vayimalei Haman am Mordechai chema. Haman got angry at Mordechai, right? And he was mad. He was mad. And he comes home. Now, by the way, the king gets mad a few times. But what does the king do after he gets mad? He gets unmad. V'chamat hamelech shachacha. I think that appears twice in the Megillah, right? They tell, I think it was when they're going to have a new king. Right? So it says, in other words, the king gets mad, but his anger is, he gets over it. I can't find the verse right now, but you have it later. You have it twice. By Haman, his anger never subsides. It says in the Megillah a couple times, Haman gets angry, but his anger never, it's just interesting. Haman is like this total, you know, he can't get over his anger. And so he comes home now. That's a tragedy of life. And the same thing happens on the next party, right? He comes, he's the only one. What does he say? What does he say in verse 13? Turn the page. Or verse 12. And the bottom page. Vayomer man, af lo yibi Esther malchei melech yimushta asher asata kimoti. Wow, the queen Esther brought to the king only me. I'm like the most important person. There's the king and me. Esther's having a party, the queen, and she invites the king and me. Wow. The gamla machara nikaru alachimach. And tomorrow also, two parties in a row, just with me and the king. V'choze einenu shoveli. And none of this is worth it. It's worthless to me. V'chole desher nivaret Mordechai ha-Yehudi. Yoshev v'shar melech. See, the Mordechai, the dirty Jew, sitting at the king's gate. None of it is. I can be the richest guy in the world. I can have everything in the world. If that stupid old Jew won't bow down to me, I have nothing. What a tragedy. Of course, we all have a little of Haman in us. You know, we got everything and one little thing, and oh, it's like it ruins everything. Like, put life in perspective a little bit. But that's, right? So we're all a little bit of Haman. Like we get to Pesach, so we're all like the four sons. We all have all of the four children in us. Anyway, so that's, now, what happens? What does his wife say? So what happens? So his wife says, "Vatomer lo zeres ishto v'cholo avav." Who are Becholo Avav? All the people who love him. Who's that? I don't know. His kids? I don't know. It doesn't say. I point that out because in the next verse, the word Oavav is going to be switched. I think that's it's significant. Zeresh Yishto tells him what? Make a tree. This is not the first woman who tells her husband to take something from a tree, do something with the tree. You know, like remember, where's Haman in the Torah? We spoke a few weeks ago. Hamin ha'etz, asher achalta. Did you eat from the tree at Tordnati? So we have a different explanation a few weeks ago. But here it's obviously Haman, that's the downfall of Adam. And Adam and Chava, and of course Adam blames his wife, but it's the wife. And here you have Zeresh telling her husband, build for me, you build gallows with the tree. It's clearly, obviously, the you know, this is a commentary, so to speak, on Bereshit. Now, and then you come to the morning, you'll hang Haman, and that's great. Now he's happy. Vayas A to make tree. But by the way, this is also probably exaggerated. How big is the tree? How big is Chamishim Amah? How big is an Amah? The elbow to the middle finger. So between in modern language, you know, there let's say 18 to 24 inches. Let's say we'll take the smaller measurement. So it's 75 feet. It's a pretty high gallows to build. Whether it means 75 feet or it's just exact, but that's pretty tall to build basically in one day. They had to build it like overnight. Had to get a lot of people to build this thing.
Mennonites.
I'm sorry?
Mennonites.
Mennonites, okay. All right. Now, Balayla Hahu, Nadada, Shnat HaMelech, we did the right. That's what the king can't sleep. The king can't sleep. Well, the rabbis say it's God, but let's see. Why can't the king sleep?
Suspicious.
We don't know.
Insecure.
So David's saying, right, one way to read all this whole story is he's getting a little bit nervous. What's this Haman? Maybe Haman's not, and of course that would be Esther's plan. Maybe Haman, I can't trust him so much anymore. Now, at this point it's not so much, it's really going to come out later. Haman hasn't really done anything yet. Haman's just been invited to come to two parties. He tells his wife, you know, it's worth this if I can't kill Mordechai. But Haman really hasn't done anything yet to arouse the suspicion of the king. He will soon. So I'm not sure that's why the king can't. It could be. He's wondering what Esther wants. Forget what in the world, what's with my nutty wife? Like, what kind of, you know, who did I choose as this queen? Because two, you know, she's not telling me what she wants. Vayomer laviyat sefer zichronot divrei hayamim. So bring, if you want to fall asleep, you read politics, you read, you know, who the kings were. Was insomnia. So you read about who this prime minister was and that prime minister, you fall asleep. By any degree, now, I actually find it, of course, very interesting. Where else do we have, and this is not in the Bible, but it's in the Mishnah, where else do we have idea of reading for somebody at night? This I haven't seen anywhere, but I think it's valid. So in the first parak, the first chapter in the Mishnayos of Yuma, which talks about the service of Yom Kippur. So the Kohen Gadol was not allowed to sleep the night of Yom Kippur. He had to stay up all night. That was a hard day. Kohen Gadol had to work, and he had to work hard. The rest of the year, he didn't have to work too hard. But Yom Kippur, he had to work really hard, and he couldn't sleep. He wasn't allowed to sleep. So they said, that what would they do to keep him up? If he knew how to learn, he would read. But many Kohanim Gadol, we know, is a corrupt system. I mean, tragically, many of the Kohanim bought their position. They were not worthy to be high priests. There's corruption and religion have gone together, unfortunately, for a long time. Power corrupts and religious power corrupts. The priest, you know, was a bought off. That's well known in the Second Temple. That's why it was such all the infighting in the Jewish people. So they would read for him all night. So I know somehow this reminds me again. It's the way the rabbis present it is that God can't sleep or keeping up. It's sort of like Yom Kippur night. And remember, Achashverosh thinks he's God, or for sure at least is the high priest, right? So he's like, you know, staying up all night in a sense. This is the night of judgment, and Achashverosh can't. That's not obvious. Achashverosh doesn't have this in mind. But you know, we as the reader, but remember, whoever wrote the Megillah is not just writing what happened. They're writing for us, right? So he says, let's bring it. And he hears that Mordechai had saved his life. And he wants to know what they did to him. So there's not, we never gave him anything. Why didn't Achashverosh do anything at the time? when he saved his life, right? What reward do we give Mordechai? He said, we didn't give him any reward. Why? I have no idea why. I don't know. I was hoping you would know, but I don't know why. The Megillah doesn't tell us. See, after surmise, maybe at that point he was too concerned about his life. He was too, which would explain now what happens. He's, nothing's done. That's the end of verse 3. And what is the word? So what should the king say next? Let's give him a reward, right? What does he, you know? He said, what reward do we give to Mordechai? He said, we gave him nothing. So how should the conversation go on? Okay, let's give him something. But there's an interruption. Vayomer HaMelech Mibachatzer. Who's in the courtyard? His ears are attuned. He hears somebody. Now, the way I just said it, I'm reading it. That's not the only way to read it. He's super sensitive to assassination attempts, which is why he appointed Haman in the first place, to save his life, right? So he, who's in there? I hear sounds. Now, Haman's coming at 4 o'clock in the morning because he wants to kill Mordechai before the party is going to start. So he's getting there. Zrizi Makdima, like Avram went to the Akedah early in the morning. The rabbis say he got up early in the morning. By the way, the amazing thing is, Amram Avinu could sleep on the night of the Akedah. The Torah actually tells us, and when the Torah tells us things like this, it's not telling us, like I told you, when he fed him the food, it says, Vayashkem Avraham Baboker. Avram got up in the morning. What does that mean? It means he was sleeping before he got up. So why is the Torah telling us that? The Torah is telling us that, first of all, no, he's not. In other words, God told him to do something. So he had all night to think about it. He actually had 3 days to think about it, as we said. But he didn't rush to do it like he was in a trance, like they convince all the terrorists so they can't think. He had time to think it over, and he didn't do it immediately, but he could sleep. That's an amazing thing. He felt if God's telling, he felt God is guiding him, I can be comfortable. Akashir can't sleep. It's very interesting, I think. So he's very attuned. Who's there? Because you think maybe it's an assassinate them. Have a Haman. Oh, Haman. Okay, it's Haman. Haman coming. So he said. So Haman walks in, and Vayamru Narei Melech Elav. Hine Haman Omei Bechatzer. Vayovah Melech Avo. Bring in Haman. Bring in. He's our trusted advisor. Okay. It's maybe a little strange why Haman's coming at 4 in the morning, but he likes him. Vayavo Haman, verse 6. So Haman walks in. So what should he say to Haman? Yeah, so that's not what he says. That's not what he says. He's happy it's Haman. He's relaxed. He's relaxed. So he said, what should we do to the person who the king wants to, honor? And of course, Vayomer Haman, it's so like about life, We think the world revolves around us, So who else could the king want to give honor to? I mean, it's only me. I'm the king's thing. I was just invited to 2 parties in a row. I mean, I'm the greatest. For sure the king wants to honor me. So now you begin to see what Haman's like. Wear the king's clothing, v'sus, and ride on the king's horse. Things you're not allowed to do in Jewish law. You're not allowed to. The king is the only person in Jewish law who cannot waive the honor that is due to him. Apparently, we advise parents to waive the honor, because it's so hard to properly honor a parent. We tell parents, tell your children they don't have to honor you so much. I mean, a little bit, yes, but if you knew what honor, real high, it's too hard. A teacher is entitled to honor. He can waive the honor. It's his Torah. But a king can't waive the honor, because we know it's not the king. It's the office of the president. It's the office. We're not honoring the person. We're honoring the Torah scholar. We're honoring the parent, the person. We're not honoring the king as the person. Otherwise, the United States, what would you do? But you honor the White House. You honor the occupant of the White House. The White House is deserving of honor. You honor the king. So a king can never annul. You didn't like that sometimes. One, I'm sorry. You didn't like my Trump comment, I'm sorry. What can I do? I went over everybody's head. I know I went over his head where nobody liked it. Okay, I don't normally like politics, but the whole Megillah is all politics. Whatever, we can talk about that later. So why Trump I make an exception. Like Trump why I make an exception.
Trump could be a chashverosh.
Don't laugh. Before he became the president, even, or maybe when he was running for president, I think it was in our time, somebody gave up, and not the first one who said it. He drew an exact parallel between Trump and Ahasuerus. It's actually a phenomenal parallel. On the one hand, he does nice things, he does good to people like Israel. I don't want to get into it, but Correct. I think Trump and Ahasuerus, and I was talking to a good friend of mine who lives in Israel. When they call the elections in Israel, talk about got the whole world. Israel, Canada, and America. I mean, it's like, oh, okay. Canada's like, you know, now it's a little exciting here. We don't normally get politics like that here. But it's still not on the level of, like, Israel. I mean, it's actually scary. That's actually very troublesome. And again, I don't like to talk so much, but I think I'm very troubled with what's going on in Israel. I think it's awful. This election is just bringing out, I hate to say it, I think... Netanyahu is ruining all the good he's done. He's done a lot of good, but what he's doing now is just awful, I think, for the future of Israel. You don't have to agree with me. Maybe I shouldn't have said it. Maybe nobody will be here next week after. you can disagree with me, but I'm sorry. Anyways, but I say it not as a political thing. I say it as a religious matter. I'm saying it, in other words, the kvod adam, that every person... Jew, Arab, non-religious Jew, leftist, rightist, you know, the left are also created in the image of God. And the right are created, everybody's created in the image of God. It's a big problem what's going on. And the language that's being used, it's the whole political, the whole world, all of the popular things. It's a religious thing we have to worry about. Forget who you vote for, what policies you like. But anyways, why was I saying that? But I had a friend in Israel, I was talking about the Israeli elections, and, you know, I said... Thank God I can't vote in Israel, you know, whatever. So, he said, listen, I told him, I'm not sure what Trump has done is so good for Israel. Because it could be, I don't know, like, umi odeya, but it could be Trump has now driven a wedge. Trump and Netanyahu have reached the point where Republicans are for Israel and Democrats are against Israel. Just this week, we see what's going on. So, for the first time in the history of Israel, Israel is no longer a bipartisan issue. And that is way worse than I couldn't care less where the embassy is. You can put the embassy in Timbuktu for all I care. You know, it's not worth it. If Israel's going to become a partisan issue, we're in big trouble. We're in big, big trouble. I don't know. I'm not sure even Trump is even good for Israel. I don't even know if he's good. We said everything else. I don't know if he's good for Israel yet. And who knows what the peace plan will be, you know, the deal of the century. Okay, listen, if he makes peace, if Trump can make peace, give him all the credit in the world. It'll be beautiful, wonderful. We'll see. But my friend said in Israel, he lives in Male Adumim, he said, Trump, that's a Ahasuerus. Okay. In other words, Israelis, everywhere in the world, everybody hates Trump except in Israel. Trump has like a 9% approval rating in Israel. Yeah, everybody knows that, right? So it doesn't look so good. You know, there's something with everybody in the world. They said, no, Ahasuerus. Okay, I'm sorry, I talked way too much politics. People I don't know. After maybe the Moretzkis know me for years, so they know. But I'm sorry. You can wipe that out, what I said. Okay. But it is, there's something to think about. Anyway, so where are we at? We have to end soon. So, but he says, the king cannot annul his honor. You have to honor Trump. No matter what you think of him, the office of the presidency requires honor. So Haman, of course, breaks that honor. But Hasus, Asheri, and he ride the horse. So you see, this is the turning point. This is where Haman falls into the trap. Where up at this point, Haman hasn't really done anything wrong. I mean, not knowing into Ahasuerus. But when Haman says, what should you give honor? You should treat this person like the king. Now, Ahasuerus isn't stupid. He knows who Haman has in mind. I'm sure he knows who Haman has in mind. That's why he asked him. It was like probably a setup because it is a little strange. Why are you coming at 4 a.m? Like, you know, it's a little bit strange. So he says, take the source. And then he says, you know, I can imagine Haman's reaction. Vayomer HaMelech Laman Maher Kach Maher. Maharu, quickly. Remember, everything switches in 1 second. Jewish history, sometimes in 1 second, everything switches. Maharu, how quickly. We spoke about the Holocaust, how quickly that happened out of the blue. Who could have expected it? And sometimes our redemption comes out of the blue. So, Maharu, you have that in the Maharu Laviyadamat. Maher, Kacha Levusha Sus, Kashir, Vasakhen Mordechai Yudi. Don't, and then the last point we'll make, Haman comes back. So, that's, you can imagine Haman's reaction when he hears that. So, he comes back. Nidchav Avel, he's an Avelus, he's mourning. Avel v'chafui rush, he's like, oh my, if you thought he was angry before, the Mordechai wouldn't bow down. This is like, you know, he's finished. And the rabbis say, you know, people were throwing stuff on Haman on the roofs, you know. Rabbis like to, you know, they gave it to Haman, you know, people are throwing whatever. V'yisaper Haman l'zeresh ishto u'lechol ohavav. So he told, again, his wife and all the people he loved, because they were the people who built the tree. why did you tell me to build a tree for Mordechai? Like, there's no way we can kill Mordechai. In other words, he comes back, you told me to do X, forget X, we got to go to plan B now, because we're not hanging Haman. No. He doesn't think he's going to get hung yet. He's not that astute. But he realized it. But it's very interesting. So who responds? Now the wise people say. It's not the people who love him. People who love him in a dictatorship, they tell you what you want to hear.
Right.
People love you. But the wise people told him, I want to tell you something. Mordechai's Jewish. Oh, we didn't know. Mizera Yehudi Mordechai. Asher Echelotin, the fall of Anab, the one you began to fall, finished. Once the Jewish people are ruled, you can't stop them. That's it. It's all over. They're warning him. Like, you better think of big strategy because Mordechai's in the king's good graces. They run to bring Haman to the party. Now he's got to come to the party too. And now we'll stop here. We're in the middle of our suspense. But that's it. And please God, next week is the last week. I hope you'll forgive me for my political editorializing. You'll come back. Please God, next week we'll wrap up the Megillah. Sort of some of makes few interesting points. And, any questions? But there's a lot. The Megillah is a story. We were talking about it's a story of Jewish history. It's a story of us too as individuals, honor and arrogance and the uncertainty of life, how things, the circle of life, how in one moment everything flips from who's on top and who's on the bottom. And that's, we all know this to be true. Yes.
It's interesting when he reads his records, we don't think about it, but his records were in his bedroom.
His records were?
In his bedroom. And when you go to the Forbidden City, the king also has his records in his bedroom. And the Forbidden City is the other end of the Silk Road of Persia. So he didn't send out a courier to get the books.
Okay. I mean, he always wants to have what's written.
Somebody showed me that.
Okay. I mean, you have to realize writing down in the time of the... There's no printing. Everything's written on parchment. It's not a simple thing to write.
He has his library
right. In
his bedroom.
Right. I hear. Okay. Okay, but we really have to know, like, what does Achashverosh know, what doesn't he know? But that pick up next week, please God. Okay?
Lila talk. Like, he didn't.